CliffCentral.com.
Peter Boghossian is a friend of the show, and I think someone who's well known enough to our audience at this point, somebody who has an amazing point of view on so many different things that it's never, ever boring to sit and talk to him. For as many minutes as I can get him, I like to tie him down to talk to us in different time zones, but that doesn't seem to be a problem. He's a philosopher, an author, a father, and so much more. Peter Boghossian, it's such a pleasure to welcome you back to my show.
It is.
Of talking to you.
The pleasure is entirely my own. When we've had conversations, I've been at my father died, my mother died, I've been very sick. I've suffered from Crohn's disease, so I've been at some interesting points in my life, and I've cherished our conversation. So I'm looking forward to this one.
Well, I have to say, despite all of those things which life has thrown at you, you've remained someone who I find very inspiring to talk to. And I think this time round, maybe more than any of the other times that we've spoken in the midst of the most woke of times,
yeah,
I think you've got some glimmers of hope going on at the moment. And I've seen how active you've become again on Twitter. I haven't yet. I'm still waiting to see what the landscape delivers. But right up front, I mean, you released a bunch of videos recently explaining some words, which I thought was really helpful. Even today, a bunch of people on social media were asking what woke even means.
Right.
And it's so great that we've got this library of videos where you actually explain some of these things to us in the language of both the left and people who've never ever spoken that kind of language.
Yeah, translations from wokish. So just a little background, like English wokish, a little background. Right. So after I resigned my position at Portland State University, and I had a job for life, I had continuous employment. So it wasn't exactly a gilded cage, but the place had become a kind of insane asylum where people were utterly, utterly beholden to an ideology for not only for which there was no evidence, but for which core tenets of the ideology actually conflicted with evidence. And something just came out again about trigger warnings. There's basically not only there's no evidence, but could actually injure people or make them more psychologically fragile. So anyway, so I started a nonprofit, and the whole goal of this, the North Star, is to move the needle and to move the needle on the current. So let's even take a step back from that. So our society, when I say our society, I don't just mean the United States or even the Anglosphere, the English-speaking world. Society is currently beholden by simultaneous multiple mass delusions.
Mm-hmm.
And this is no, I've been screaming about this since 2012. This is no small feat to solve. I just came across something the other day, and then I'm going to get into what you talked about directly. It was the number of times, I saw this on Twitter, the number of times the N-word has been used pre and post Musk. There's no evidence for this whatsoever. Zero evidence. It's just a meme someone's created. And the people who want to believe that there's more racism and misogyny, et cetera, are just pumping out this meme because it accords with what they already believe. But there's simply no evidence for this. But that's, to me, it's a very interesting way about how our mind works. We seek confirmatory pieces of evidence. We want to confirm what we believe, and then we want to push it out there so other people believe like we believe. So anyway, to the word. So we started making videos. I think that YouTube is a new Gutenberg press. It's a new way to reach people. It's an unbelievable vehicle to reach people. So we made videos to translate wokish words. We made videos about colleges of education. I'm talking a lot, but I'll just be quick. One of the reasons that this ideology has been so pervasive and has been able to capture so many institutions is, and it's going to sound so simple, but it's just true, it's that they've done this through manipulating the meanings of ordinary words. Right. And when you understand that, you understand diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging, all of these words.
These words do not belong to the definitions that we thought they belonged to, the dictionary definitions. And it's funny you should even mention that, because just today I saw that one of the dictionaries has redefined the term woman.
Cambridge. Correct.
Cambridge. And of course, all they're doing is creating this endless, repetitive – and circular argument of, you know, a woman is anybody who identifies as a female, but they don't then define female. So female will be anyone who identifies as a woman. And so you have this infinite regression. It just doesn't seem to be a very honest way of anybody doing business. The whole purpose of language, and I think you'll agree with me here, is so that we can have more clarity with each other, so that we can understand each other better. It seems that the determination of the woke people is to make language as cloudy and obfuscatory as possible, to make it impossible for us to communicate honestly and clearly with each other. And in so doing, to implement some sort of, I don't know what their end goal is, but it seems to me to be wholly destructive. It's not, there is no end game from their point of view that results in good things for most people.
No, you're right. It's to dismantle and disrupt, and we'll talk about that. But this language thing is utterly fascinating to me. So it went from changing the meanings of ordinary words, safety, race, woman. Now enough woke people, they've been indoctrinated by the ideology and in university systems for long enough that they're literally position themselves to change the meanings of words in dictionaries. That is an astonishing. Okay, so when you change the meanings of words in dictionaries, what are you actually doing? Well, one of the things you're actually doing is that's how we adjudicate what a word means. We go to a dictionary if we have a dispute. There are implications for saying that someone who self-identifies as and lives as a woman is an actual woman and gets treated with, I just want to, as in every single one of these conversations, I have to say what I'm confident that you believe, and I don't want to, if push back on me if I'm incorrect. Trans people should be entitled to live their life freely and without bigotry or hatred or discrimination of any kind, and they should be able to have their gender identity expressed in any way. They sleep with whoever they want. It's irrelevant to me.
As should any people in the world. I don't think
100%.
You and I 100%. Certainly have an argument. There may be people out there who are opposed to those very basic humanitarian and secular concepts, but we're not here to talk to them, and I don't think that they're particularly interested in hearing from us anyway.
100%. I think that every conversation has to lead with that. So, but you're talking about something else. You're talking about when someone has an M or an F on their driver's license, for example, and they get pulled over for drunk driving. There are certain things that are entailed by that. What jail they go to? Are they housed with men, or are they housed with women? There are certain. So these are not academic problems when we're talking about language. This has a very real consequence. Women in sports, men in sports, trans men in sports, women in people who were born biologically male in rape shelters. These have very, very real consequences for the world. Someone just told me the other day he does a lot of work with the police. They don't want to use the word, people in the community don't want to use the word gang anymore. Instead, they want to use the word group. So think about this for a second. This is so crazy. So part of the problem with that is, well, the first thing is the reason for that is they think that that's racial. Now, I don't know about you, but when I hear gang, I don't associate it with black or Asian or Jew. For me personally, there's not. And if there was, I'd say something. But
wasn't there just a very popular TV series, I forget the name of it, with a whole bunch of British gangsters from the 1920s in it who were all white as far as I could tell, unless they decided to wokeify that and throw in one or two black people. But I don't associate those gangs. Remember the movie The Gangs of New York? Also not about black people at all.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So let's just run with that for a second.
Gang is racist, supposedly.
Yeah, gang is a race word, so they want to use the word group. The problem with using the word group is that groups, they're just different word. Not all, groups of people are gangs, and so
they are non-overlapping magisteria in some cases.
Yes, that's correct.
Can I, because it's so hard for me to hold back and not kind of go in every direction with you. There's so much I
know. I feel the same way. Yeah.
So as a professor of philosophy, before you quit your job there. And I think it was a major, major thing when you did. Barry Weiss wrote about it. It was a big story across the United States. You really stood for principle there. And as a professor of philosophy, a person who'd really dedicated their life to not only studying all of that, but teaching it, was there ever a period in philosophical history, going all the way back to Solon and Socrates and Aristotle, has there ever been a point where people sought to undermine language in the way that we've discussed today?
Yeah, there was. That's the early postmodernists, the French postmodernists did. Derrida in particular, actually, Lyotard, the early French postmodernists. Helen Pluckrose had a great piece in Aereo, how French intellectuals destroyed the West. But what we're seeing now is the legacy of that tradition from the French in the 70s and the 80s and a little bit to the 90s, but in the 60s to a very small extent. But what we're seeing now is the legacy of that. And so Helen Pluckrose calls it applied postmodernism. So the original postmodernists had these ideas about reality and what you can know and subjectivity. And then that weaseled its way into the university when people started studying this. That's the other thing that I've come to think about recently, how the universities have not just, the gatekeepers of knowledge have not just fallen. They've betrayed some fundamental principles about what it means to uphold truth and reason and to think honestly about a problem. But yeah, so that's the answer. All of the stuff that we're seeing now comes from the French intellectuals.
So why would those things that you've just listed matter? Why would things like truth and honest definitions for words? Because maybe there are people, I'm trying to be charitable in my,
sure.
In my attempt to understand why great swathes of supposedly the smartest people in the most important colleges in the Western world would subject themselves to this sort of corruption and be completely comfortable with it. I'm going to be charitable and say, is it important? Are we not attaching ourselves to concepts that have just lived past their time? And maybe it is time for us to open ourselves up to the idea that there is no such thing as objective truth, that it is all about my or your or anyone else's truth. And how would that, in your opinion, either aid or undermine society?
Okay, so that's a huge question. So the first thing, why is truth important? Truth is important because if you want to lead a better life, not only do you have to be honest about the nature of the problem, but you also, if you want to construct situations outside yourself that bring about your flourishing, you have to base what you believe on what's true. One false belief, you know, I was obviously religious examples come to mind, but I'm trying not to use those, right now. One false belief at the pillars of your belief system causes you to create and change situations in your external reality that make you think that you're bringing yourself and your community closer to flourishing, but you're actually not because you have a false belief. And again, I was thinking about a religious proposition, you know, like not eating pork, or the testimony of a woman should be half that of a man, or right, what have you. Okay. But your other question is extremely interesting. So, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about this and immersed in this. Here's the problem. And I wrote about this. I published a piece on this in the Philosopher's Magazine called Deluded Departments, which my colleagues were utterly incensed about.
Oh, yeah.
So here's the problem. The problem is, and this again gets back to our conversation about words and what words mean. Smarter people are better at rationalizing. This is Michael Shermer's instinct. Michael Shermer wrote about this in The Believing Brain. He's a skeptic. He's written a number of books. He's a wonderful thinker. The smarter you are, the better you are at coming up with conclusions to bad ideas. So that's why smart people believe weird things. If you get groups of smart people together, they become even better at rationalizing bad ideas. In other words, with coming up with good reasons for bad ideas. When you look in what's happening now is in academia in particular, you cannot, 7 articles in 7 years get you tenure. You, you know, provided you have a few basic other things, like you actually show up for class, et cetera. But the big thing is publishing. So 7 articles in 7 years, you're much less likely to get a piece published if it runs against the dominant moral orthodoxy. So for example, if you say, I don't think trans women are women, and you kind of construct an argument, and this has happened over and over. The famous example is Rebecca Tuvel, who said if somebody who published a piece and attempted to publish a piece in Hypatia, who said if people can identify as a different gender, why can't they identify as a different race?
Okay.
So the issue is then, and stop me if at any time this, at any point this becomes unclear, because it's complicated. So 7 papers in 7 years gets you tenure, gets you a job for life, but you can't publish almost anything unless you write something that upholds the dominant moral orthodoxy. You write something that's morally fashionable. And when you write something that's morally fashionable, other people build upon that literature. So we've created entire veins of scholastic thought in which it's all a house of cards. People think that that these things are true. They teach it to the students. The students feed it back to the instructor. They're marked wrong if they don't give the right answer to the question. And so we've created, this is like an ideology mill. It's like a machination. It's a machine of ideology reproduction. And that's what's happening in our institutions and our universities right now.
Well, I mean, this is something that you and I have spoken about before, I think, on both my TV show and here, where we talked about the incredible work that you and two of your colleagues, you mentioned Helen Pluckrose already, and right. James Lindsay being the other one, the three of you handed all these bullshit papers in to various universities and had them immediately regaled and observed as being extraordinarily breakthrough and all the rest of it, only to ultimately reveal to these universities that you were making this stuff up because you could see how to work the system and that the system is broken.
The system is irrevocably broken, correct.
Now, if these are the people who have been teaching those who are now going to enter the workforce, who are already in the workforce, the people who are going to enter government, make decisions for where society is headed, and they've got these poisonous concepts and this complete lack of regard for things like truth,
correct,
then we start seeing the breakdown that I was talking about earlier. And this, the reason that you are uncomfortable, perhaps, I don't want to put words in your mouth, about bringing up religious counter arguments, is that very often religion is disregarded as a philosophy that has also lived past its time, that a lot of religion carries with it all kinds of dogma and, you know, unscientific, irrational, unreasonable stuff that post the Enlightenment people don't look very favorably upon. But some of that stuff, Milton, Francis of Assisi, of that stuff is probably the best antidote to this woke stuff, even if it's religious. And I say that as an atheist, as someone who doesn't believe.
Yeah.
Do you think that, because I mean, if I've had any realization in the last while, it's that the people who are religious, be they, you know, Jews, Muslims, Christians, whoever they may be, at very least have some sort of value backbone which can be relied upon to drive them in the direction of truth, as opposed to those people who do not have any such system of belief and will merely go whichever way the woke wind blows. And it worries me tremendously on that front. But I think maybe the religious people are now more my allies than my enemies.
Yeah, it's a funny, I published a piece about that called Culture War 2.0. It's a funny situation in which we find ourselves. I agree with everything you said, except for one word that you used. You used the word truth. And I don't think it's a matter of truth. I think it's a matter of social cohesion. So if you have an old, quote unquote, old religion, a traditional religion, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, there are edicts for how to have society cohere and how to, whether or not you believe in whether in the truth of those is irrelevant. They work.
Right.
And so there's something about that. I think that this is called the substitution hypothesis. And then I'll share one of the things I've been thinking about this. Is the default state just belief? We want to believe something. We want to believe anything. So let's just make sure that people believe more benign things. You know, when they bring people off of the battlefields, particularly ISIS folks, one of the things they do to deconvert them is they don't teach them that Islam is bullshit or that, you know, they shouldn't believe this nonsense. No, nobody flew to heaven on a winged horse or whatever. No, they bring in more benign interpretations of Islam to try to convince people that the more fundamentalist is a word imported from the Protestants, but these more canonical interpretations, particularly of the latter part of Islamic scripture, where all the nasty stuff is. So I think it's really important. And I've said a lot, but I'm going to stop. Is that clear so far?
Yeah. Look, I think people who care are following. I think if you've decided that this is all too complex, then perhaps you're just not as interested as Peter and I are. And that's fine. Then don't listen. We're not catering to everybody here. We're trying to explain and discuss things that I think are really worthy of discussion and may require that we lose some of the audience along the way. It's like going into battle. So don't worry about it.
Okay. So I think that there's a profound difference between saying that, you know, this subjective turn that we're seeing now, it is my lived experience, or I feel this way. Or so when you do that, and traditional religious people, and ironically, the more quote unquote fundamentalist, the more a literal interpretation of scripture that one has, the less one is likely to do that, the less one turns to lived experience. Now, it is certainly true that Christians used the testimony of the Holy Spirit.
And you often hear a lot of Christians saying that they have a personal relationship with God, and that's why they're Christians, which is much more like the whole lived experience argument.
Correct. And that's why I've predicted for almost a decade now that future versions of proselytization won't turn toward those subjective experiences. So one of the problems with the subjectivity, and again, remember, almost all of the woke stuff has a kernel of truth in it, almost all of it. So, And then they take that kernel of truth and they go to crazy land, or they go to madness and they try to institutionalize that madness.
Well, it's like a flat earth tell you, well, you know, there's this, and you'll go, wow, that's actually a good point. And before you know it, you're starting to listen to the flat earther as if they're a saint. But...
Right. Hmm. Yeah. So we have a problem here in which our institutions have been captured by people. Oh, did the lights just go on?
That's my lights. Yeah, thank God.
Okay. So we say
that? Thank God, not ironic.
Right. Okay. So we have a problem when our institutions have been captured. It really in the only institute, the only features of, for example, American life that haven't been captured by this diversity, equity, inclusion madness are professional sports teams. They have no diversity requirements. So one of the things that happens is that people start to lose trust in their institutions. They start to lose trust in the journals and academic scholarship. They start to lose trust in almost everything you could think of. You know, I think it was American Airlines wants to have diversity requirements. Okay. So I used to believe that
passengers or just for the staff?
Unfortunately for the pilots, right?
Oh, right.
So I used to think that the only reason somebody would want diversity in something like diversity in philosophy department is because they thought it wasn't important. And then I said, well, no one would want that for brain surgery or in medicine or in for their pilots. But it turned out that that ideological creep was so pervasive that now it's in medicine. Now it's in, you know, fire department hiring. Now it's in every conceivable facet of life.
This is so interesting. And we're building up to the point where, and I'm glad you were the one to bring up religion, but we're building up to this idea that this is actually a substitute religion. But before we get there, South Africa already has a quota system in our sport. Some sports more than others, but you know,
in sports.
So we're already there. And if you want to see what failure looks like, just hang on a little bit, because it's been used as an excuse, you know, oh, well, we come out of this history of, you know, racial discrimination and apartheid and everything else. And people here are obviously quite sensitive to those things. The government that's been in power for the last 28 years has made it a priority of theirs to make these what looked like cosmetic changes. So there would be street name changes and, you know, kind of, I mentioned to you, I think before, that there was a movement called Roads Must Fall at the very beginning of all of this, which started in South Africa, not surprisingly. And I don't want us to take all the blame, but I think we can take some of the credit, in inverted commas, for the genesis of this whole thing, because that movement sought to almost try to rewrite history like they want to rewrite dictionaries, for example, and to redesign sports teams on an almost cosmetic basis, whether or not they would win or not. That wasn't the most important thing. Now, I mean, I don't know of any group of people who would want to watch a sports game where the team they support does not win because they have not chosen the best people, or because they've, in principle, gone ahead, and this is that ideological creep that you're talking about, and selected people from a specific race or a specific gender or a specific sexuality or ideology or whatever, but they've couched this under the term of inclusion.
Well, if they really believe that, why don't they put midgets on basketball teams?
Maybe we're heading that way. One day someone will say, well, why not? It's not completely beyond the bounds of sanity
That's the problem, is that there's no ridiculous restriction anymore, right?
By the way, you and I have both been canceled for having the word midget in this discussion. Because
that's right. At this point, I'm like, I'm beyond any kind of remote cancellation.
I stop caring as well. Bring it on is what I say.
Right. I
want to get to your latest book, and I want to talk about where your head's at right now.
Okay.
So forgive me if I'm cutting you short. I really don't like to do that, because this kind of conversation is one that needs space to, you know, to start meaning something. You were one of the first people, you and probably Douglas Murray, who started recognizing that this whole woke movement, whatever you want to call it, this
mass flower, delusion.
Mass delusion. I mean, Gad Saad, who we've also had on the show before, identifies it as a kind of mind virus.
Yeah, he's a good friend of mine.
That's probably one of the better definitions too. Although I've got to give you and Douglas Murray credit for this, because you started to notice that there were rituals associated with this, that there was a faithful in the center of this. It mimics some of the most brutal proto-religions that we...
Correct.
That we can see if we study a little bit of history. And I'm not talking that you don't have to be someone who's, you know, written 2,000 page books on the history of religion to pick up on these things. Where did it all start to click for you that this was not just a philosophy, that it was mushrooming into a religion?
Yeah. So I published a paper with James Lindsay, Jim is also a good friend of mine, in 2014 called Privilege is the Original Sin. And the thesis was exactly what you think it was, that privilege operates in the same way as original sin does. And it was published in a piece at a venue that's no longer operating. It's called All Think. So privilege offers and operates analogously to original sin. You can't wipe it away. It's a stain. Unlike original sin, you can kind of wash it away through the blood of Christ, or, you know, whatever particular religious flavor one happens to believe, accepting Jesus in one's heart or what have you. So some of the things for me were very small things. For example, I would ask people, and I live in the epicenter of this. So I live in Portland, and I was teaching at Portland State University, which had become an unbelievable cesspool, like an ideology factory that is just unthinkable. And so I would ask people, you know, what is your evidence for this? But I really watched my tone. Like, but I was genuinely curious around 2012. Why do why are we making this a policy? Why are we I honestly don't understand this. And instead of saying, well, here's the evidence, people became upset with me. And then people became really upset with me. So then I started looking for the evidence myself. So then I started reading the source material. I started reading the literature. I started looking. And that's when I understood it was just a massive revelation to me. All of this stuff has been idea laundered. Like, it's idea laundered. In other words, it's been people have a moral feeling. They find other people who are in academia who have this moral feeling. They write a paper about it. They publish it. And it, out from the other end comes knowledge. And then they're claiming that this stuff is knowledge. So, but it's not knowledge. It's just the musings of ideologues, right? That's all. That's simply all it is. So I think I had a, whether or not you want to think this is good or bad, but I think that living in Portland and being at my former university where people were complete believers. But that's the other thing. You don't really know who's a complete believer, because when you create a culture of fear, nobody's willing to speak up against the orthodoxy and say the emperor has no clothes. So you're not really sure who believes this stuff, but it's certainly, from their verbal behavior, it certainly appeared as if they were true believers.
Do you have any idea, while we're on this subject, because there's so many others we have to cross to, but do you have any idea why this is particularly attractive as a philosophy stroke religion to college educated white women? Because they seem to be the leading edge, which is so interesting, because actually this is probably one of the most, the least threatened, the least oppressed, the most protected groups in certainly the Western world. I mean, you know, women don't work on oil rigs and go to the army and you know, fight on the front lines. And despite all the talk about the glass ceiling and, you know, how women in the workplace have a hard time. And yes, there are obviously terrible men who do terrible things to women all the time. But by and large, the white Western college educated woman has the best kind of living available to any human being in all of recorded history. That group is the most intent on shitting all over Western civilization. Why do you think that is? Is it guilt?
I don't know. I was just talking to James Lindsay about that the other day. I personally don't know. That's a piece of the puzzle I haven't figured out. So I don't know the answer to that.
Wow. Okay. Well, there's an honest answer if ever there was. I'm still trying to figure it out too. I think it may have something to do with guilt. I think it may have something to do with, you know, this maybe it's this passive aggressive stuff that has always plagued human society. I don't know, but I mean, the fact that you also don't know makes me feel a bit better about not having figured it out. So talking about these your latest book, I mean, let's get straight into this, because you are a prolific writer. You mentioned it already in this discussion, a couple of these articles, some of which have been received with huge opprobrium, some of which have cost you friends. Cost you jobs, some of which have cost you relationships, all kinds of things here. I had an interesting conversation with a friend of mine today, and I said, you know, is it worth it? Because every time someone like you puts pen to paper or does an interview with me, or, you know, I pick up a microphone and say something which I think is fairly innocuous and it gets me into huge trouble.
Yeah.
There's a part of me that goes, well, you could just choose to live a happy life. You don't have to fight all these battles.
True.
Do you often feel like, you know, why am I doing this? Because I could still have that cushy job where I'd be guaranteed, you know, an income. My kids wouldn't have to worry. I the house would be paid for. I could have a nice life. Why am I fighting battles that it seems sometimes the rest of academia anyway are dead against, and I'll be fighting them until I'm dead? You think it's worth it?
I mean, I can tell you with unshakable certainty that it is absolutely worth it. I think it's a part of it is a kind of temperament. I just have zero toleration for bullshit, like zero. But the other part is it comes down to personal integrity. I cannot give lip service to a deranged ideology. I just am incapable of it. And I cannot stand by while there's witch hunts and seeing the things that I truly do cherish, what enlightenment values, Western civilization. I just cannot stand by while a bunch of deranged maniacs try to rip the whole thing down and offer nothing in its place. Nothing. So for me, it was a question of keeping my integrity, of maintaining my integrity. And I guess I'm kind of an intellectual pugilist, you know, like I wanted to fight back. I wanted to use this. So listen, this is one of the things I have to say if someone's listening to this. And this took me a very, very long time to figure out. And it's also a hard pill to swallow. There are some people who have absolutely nothing to contribute to a conversation. Nothing. Zero. In fact, listening to them is actually a bad thing. So if I don't know how to fly a plane, or if you don't know how to fly a plane, right? Why would you listen to somebody giving you, if you wouldn't listen to their advice, you wouldn't listen to their criticism. So that's I think everybody kind of harbors this notion, oh, you know, maybe I'm wrong. And that's a good notion to that's a good notion to have, because you always want to correct your beliefs and figure out what's true. But there are some people who have nothing of substance and meaningful to contribute to anything. So once you understand that, you can just completely ignore anything they have to say. Because analogously, again, they don't know how to fly a plane. So why should you listen to them?
Yeah, I mean, often though, philosophy, your subject, is given a bit of a free pass on that front, because
totally,
you know, we assume that all philosophies are equal, or at least they deserve an airing. They're not. I mean, like,
no, the Taliban should not be on the Women's Rights Council. The Iranians were trying to take. They should not be. There are some people.
Christopher Hitchens once said, and it got him into huge trouble back then, before there was cancel culture or any of this stuff. And I remember thinking, well, that's a fairly profound thing to say. He used to say that the terminus of banal multiculturalism is a point where nothing has any value, and we may as well not invest any time or effort in things like civilization. Right. And that's a very profound thing to say. And what it essentially means is that all cultures are not equal, and that some cultures have proven to withstand the rigors of time and of many different political, social, economic movements, and that those should be regarded with some, even if it's not respect, at least some intellectual humility.
Yeah.
From the point of view of modern philosophers.
100%. Yeah. So that's part of the problem. You cannot be both a relativist and a multiculturalist. I mean, and an egalitarian. You cannot say that all cultures are relative and that all cultures are equal. Because in order to say all cultures are equal, there has to be a standard by which you hold them to. So part of that, you said your audience can take it. So I'll give you some deep. Okay. So if you can't be both egalitarian and relativist, one of the advantages that people who participate in this ideology have, the woke ideology, is they don't have to do what you and I have to do, and what people for thousands of years, you've asked me if there's ever been an historical break from this before. Like, they don't have to abide by the rule of non-contradiction. They don't have to. All they can do is, what they do is they just resort to their personal experience, their lived experience. So they don't have to do the intellectual work to figure out an argument to rebut it, because they believe that arguments themselves embedded within the argument is a way for privilege to preserve itself. So
they have a very powerful weapon on their side, in that they,
yes,
they can adopt this point of view and never have to do any heavy lifting. So it is ultimately a kind of intellectual laziness and bankruptcy as well.
Yeah, it's even worse than that, because if you are lazy, that's fine. It's a way for the ideology to prevent itself from being dislodged, because it can instantly, anytime a challenge comes in, so it's kind of like, again, back to the religion thing, it's kind of like, oh, the devil made me, you know, it's from the devil, don't listen to it, doubt your doubts. It's a famous quote from the head of the Mormon Church. So the idea that we can exempt ourselves from the tools that we use to figure out problems, because those tools themselves, from Aubrey Lord, the master's tools cannot disable the master's house, those tools themselves are responsible for racism and patriarchy and oppression. So we can't use those. We have to use something else. Like, we have to listen to the lived experience of people who have been historically oppressed, right? So they have not only a different worldview and framework, but even people who have a different worldview, I'm thinking in this country, like the far right and the far left, even these people, unless you go super far, they agree on, for example, that you can look at data to figure out whether or not trickle-down economics is good for poor people. But we're now dealing with a different problem of a class of people who exempt themselves from the tools of reasoning and discerning judgment, and to use a big word.
Even language. I mean, historical oppression. Let's just take those two words. Mm-hmm. There is not even agreement between people inside of wokeism about what is actually historical, because that, you know, many of them will say, well, history is actually a completely subjective thing and history is only written by the victors, so we don't know the true history, plus history is written by men or whatever else, so therefore we can just completely disregard it.
Right.
And oppression to them only works in one direction, right? I mean, this is where, you know, famously people like Don Lemon have found themselves speechless when somebody who is well-versed in history, like, you know, particularly the history of slavery, for example, and then they tell him what actually happened during the North Atlantic slave trade and how that came to an end and who it was who put it to an end and how it was all done and who still continues to trade in slaves today. And then someone like Don Lemon, who's definitely a product of the left, finds himself in a situation where he suddenly has to accept publicly on his live TV show.
I heard that interview, yeah.
I think they have it wrong. I'm seeing more and more of this now, and I wanted to fast forward quickly to what's happening on Twitter at the moment, because just yesterday,
it's amazing, again, isn't it?
Elon Musk, who's having, I think he's having the most fun he's ever
I love the life. Man. I think he's fantastic.
Well, at least then South Africa can make up for what we started with roads must fall by hopefully having, you know, one of our own sons try to purify things a little bit, or at least bring things out into the light. I wouldn't consider him any kind of messianic character, but to put $44 billion of your own money into something which you don't immediately see a profit mechanism for is one of the most altruistic things. It makes Bill Gates and Warren Buffett look like small fry in the world of philanthropy. But we digress. This guy is arguing things like pronouns, and I mean, he's going right into the heart and soul of this beast. He's saying, you know, prosecute Fauci, for example, as his pronoun. This is, and obviously the part of that really offended people was the pronoun part, not the Fauci. Right. I want to know what you think of what's going on here, and whether you think this is going to be a first real strike from the other side. Well, you know, people like you have been laboring hard in the background. This is at a level that you and I we couldn't affect the discourse at, even if we tried our hardest. We've been doing that already. But this guy has just picked up the biggest sword of all, their favorite plaything, the left's favorite plaything, and he has now completely removed their authority over it, which is driving them crazy.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, this is so interesting. And if you're not on Twitter, you should totally jump on Twitter, because it's a whole world. I found that Twitter has become fun again. So one of the things that you see, and it's interesting, I think in the last month, my follower count, I don't know, I don't really keep too close of a track to it, although I have since Elon Musk took over. So it's gone up like 5,000. I think you're at like 2 million or something, isn't that?
I must be honest with you. I have not logged on. I'm going to go and check after this interview. I'm not going to try and get in now. I can't even remember my password, but it's possible. I think everybody kind of on the non-woke left side of things has probably seen a major boost in their following, not because of any artificial skullduggery, but because that was always going on and it was being hidden.
Correct. And they would go before Congress and they say, we're not shadow banning. We're not, you know, de-boosting. Yeah. And they were that's the other thing. I'm trying to think of how to say this without saying these people, but I can't seem to. These people are pathological liars. Like the reward center in their brain. I'm telling you, this is an undiagnosed mental disorder. We don't have a name for it yet. These people are pathological liars. So to the extent that they would perjure themselves think about that. Yep. Okay. So one of the things that you see happening on Twitter is, and this gets back to what I said before, many woke people are just getting off of Twitter. They're quitting Twitter. My speculation, my hypothesis is that the reason that they're getting off of Twitter is not because they think this is going to be some kind of a racist thing or anything. It's because their arguments cannot sustain criticism.
Well, it's the same reason they won't have a debate with you.
100%, yes.
Or with people like, you know, let's just...
Douglas
Murray, Ben Shapiro.
Andrew Doyle. Right.
They won't argue with these people because right.
they will argue with Ben. They will argue with Ben because Ben has, and I blurbed his last book. I love Ben. I think he's great. I'm going to be on a show in Florida. The Authoritarian Impulse was a great book, by the way. They'll argue with him because he has some chinks in his armor, not intellectual chinks in his armor, but there are people who are kind of specialists like myself in this woke stuff, and I'm not beholden to another set of values. So Ben is an Orthodox Jew. I'm a correct total atheist.
They will use that against him.
But, correct.
But to get back to the discussion, so Elon is upsetting them more than anything you and I could have done.
Right. Now think about this. Here's the guy they should love electric cars, and the whole ESG thing I don't want to talk about, but you know, now people saying, well, I won't buy Tesla and I won't. Okay. So listen, this is what happens. So
you never cared about the environment anyway, did you? That wasn't, right. The environment was just a cudgel to use against your
100%
intellectual and ideological enemies. You didn't care about that stuff. And we can now see through you.
Yeah. And why just think, I mean, it's so crazy. Think about the fact that people, okay, to really understand this, the fact that people are upset that there's a platform that allows for free speech, open inquiry, dialogue, discourse. And yeah, there's going to be some nastiness that comes along with it. Absolutely. Nobody's denying that. But just think about the mindset. What belief would one have to hold to think that's a bad thing? The belief that you would have to hold is to think that there's something inherent in speech itself that's bad. And that's the belief they hold. And well, that is the undermining.
We crossed that bridge at the beginning of this discussion when we decided between us that it was fairly evident to anyone who was looking that they don't appreciate definition and words and meaning.
Correct.
So it's all a plaything to them. And therefore, why would they care about, you know, the value of free speech if speech itself is just another tool in the arsenal?
Correct. So as you've not pointed out directly, but we can infer, a reasonable person can infer from this conversation. And I think Elon Musk actually tweeted out something like, and I retweeted it, you know, wokeism is just the problem. It's the problem that we have to get rid of. We should pull up the tweet, the quotation, and put it in there. And I think that that's correct. I think that there are other problems that are significant, but wokeism, very significant, but wokeism is preventing us from addressing those problems because it's removing the tools that we need to figure out what's true. And instead, it's substituting the feelings of people who have no expertise in the subject matter whatsoever. So it's making every problem that we face communally impossible. And when you take words like gang out and put in group, we can't even identify what the problem is. We can't say, well, there's a gang member, he's having a funeral, and, well, how do the police know if they should go to the funeral of a group member?
Yeah, exactly. We're actually making everything harder for everyone in society. How about this obsession? And it seems to me like there is a huge undersupply of racism, which we should be very grateful of in the world today. We should be grateful that we live at a time where it is extremely hard to find real world direct examples of people being overtly racist. That is a huge achievement of the modern West, and something which, despite all of the sins of slavery, which are not unique to the West, all of the sins of racism and racial discrimination, which you can argue were better or worse in the West, but happened all over the world,
right?
Even within communities of color, to use the terminology that is so often used by people who argue this. That in some way, we should take stock of how good things are. But it seems that this unquenchable thirst for racism, which is really the one that they're most hungry for, because, you know, the trans thing is, it's kind of still somewhat new. I don't think you're going to find any self-respecting person who will attempt to defend slavery or racism in the modern world. If they do, they'll very quickly pay a very heavy price for that, which in itself solves the problem. But there is this unquenchable thirst to the point where you have people making up just total hoaxes.
Right. Yeah. Wilfred Riley has a book about that, Hate Crimes Hoax. It's a wonderful book that's eye-opening. So many of these, you know, racial hate, quote-unquote hate crimes, they're just hoaxes by people of that race or people of that particular sexual orientation. And there's overwhelming evidence from Steven Pinker and Michael Shermer and others that the moral arc is bending towards justice. You know, the racism, for example, the hammer blows of modernity are just beating that down. So a break from this. So when you make an excuse for yourself not to do intellectual work and figure stuff out, one of the things that you can exempt yourself from is understanding history. The moral arc is bending towards justice. And you mentioned Douglas Murray, is a friend of mine. You know, Douglas Murray has said, we have a Nazi problem. There are not enough Nazis, so we have to make them up. You know, I put a tweet out a year ago. We should only use the word Nazi for National Socialist. And people went fucking crazy. I mean, it was insane. Now look at the consequence of this. Now in Ukraine, for example, Putin is saying the initial reason for the war was, well, there are a bunch of Nazis over there. We've got to denazify Ukraine. So it's just an example of what happens when you play fast and loose with language. You give people an excuse to do bad things. But you're right. Among other things. But you're right. This is one of the things that we see right now in the world.
So there's an insatiable thirst also for people to get offended. And 100%. I wonder, when someone writes the story of our generation, the generations that are alive now in 2022, I wonder what they'll say about our moral maturity, that we were so quick to anger for a civilized modern society. And you know, there are some countries that have behaved themselves far better than the United States
or South Africa.
So I'm not, here is for me, no equivocation whatsoever. It appears fairly obvious that there are huge groups of people whose entire purpose from their waking moment until the going to sleep at night is 100%. To be upset and outraged by things that either do not affect them at all or affect them so indirectly that it is more than the six steps of Kevin Bacon or whatever else you want to call it.
Yeah.
They would have a better time arguing in a language they had never spoken before in their life.
Yeah. Okay. So sometimes I feel you and I are the same person. I'm just an older version of you. So I got back.
I'll take it.
I came back from 2 months in Eastern Europe. I lived in Hungary and I did filming in Romania and Hungary. And I did this thing on my YouTube channel. It's Peter Boghossian, Dr. Peter Boghossian or something, where I set up lines of tape on a street. I don't know if you've seen this, but these are really interesting. They're called spectrum street epistemology. It's basically epistemology, taking what you know, and I'm answering your comment directly, taking what you know and asking people if they're justified in what they believe, and then having them move to a line. So strongly agree, slightly agree, neutral, and the other side. And so then you would ask people a series of questions, etc. And one of the things that I noticed from doing this, I don't even know how many times we're going to release these videos in January, is that nobody and I was literally standing on a street corner interviewing anybody who would come by playing this thought experiment with this thought game. There was not a single person in all of Hungary or Romania and the places where I was who was looking for a reason to be offended. Nobody was outraged at anything anybody said. But if you watch my videos on college campuses, people are insane. They go, they're seeking. They're so nasty. And that's the other thing. This ideology bundles itself up. Oh, we care about people. This no. And just while I'm on the thought, one of the things that you notice about people who are deep in this ideology is they all have the same voice. They speak in a kind of saccharine way that's concealing a vicious nastiness. If you watch the
like latent resentment, and it seems that's why they have to go up at the end of every sentence.
That's right.
They're trying to lift their own spirit to not sound quite as curmudgeonly as their spirit must actually be.
Yeah, it's like a cult.
And they're humorless. They are, and that to me is the part. I mean, you're an academic, you're a man of letters, you're this prolific author and this big thinker. I'm much more attracted to the idea of just having fun conversations where people can laugh and be themselves. You never have fun conversations with these guys. They don't have a sense of humor at all.
Yeah, that's why they were so pissed off about the grievance studies hoax, you know, about the dog rape and all that stuff. That's why they were so enraged about that, because it was funny and it drove a heart through their ideology. But it was interesting when I was asking people these questions in Eastern Europe, and I'm going to do this in Puerto Rico and Australia in the coming months. But I was just really interested in how considered they were. It was just as if I had walked into a different world. And I want to say, you know, I read and blurbed Constantine Kissin's book, A Love Letter to America, which is wonderful. And in that book, he talked about where he grew up in the Soviet Union.
I've listened to one or two of his podcasts. He's in
the trigonometry guy. He's a super good guy. He's become a friend of mine. Yeah. It's just like actors. You're always wondering, like, how do these actors know all these other actors? It's because they're in the same, like, I'm in the same, is what I do. That's how I know all these people. But, you know, one of the things that the United States is exporting right now is, I was a massive believer up until very recently that we had to export American values, equality under the law, Miranda rights, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. But now the values that we're exporting, and I just wrote the foreword to Majiv Raholtra's book, Snakes in the Ganga. This book is truly unbelievable. It's an 864-page tome about how the United States exports wokeism as a neo-colonial export that colonizes Indianism.
Right. And this guy is a tremendous
holy shit
of Indian culture and tradition.
Dude, this guy is on another level.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I mean, he is on another level. Like, holy shit. I mean, truly at this point I can say I know some of the smartest people in the English speaking world. This guy is he's so wise. That's the perfect word. But anyway, values.
He's got a problem, and Constantine is saying that America used to be a place. I think I'm certainly not trying to short circuit this, but I just so I understand it. America used to be a place that exported good ideas, ideas that were humanitarian, that were based on, you know, Enlightenment ideals, perhaps, that were for the good of all humanity, that sought to bring a measure of fairness to the world, and that now it's suddenly become about America exporting the extreme views of the far left by forcing, you know, the embassy in a place where there are no gay rights whatsoever to fly the trans flag. I mean, it's just not going to fly, right?
Right. Well, he's claiming, like, his love letter was a love letter to America about 20 years ago. And I'm claiming every single thing you just said. You know, it's really it's heartbreaking. It's just heartbreaking. And it's not the left values that we're exporting. It's woke values. That's what we've become the world's predominant exporter of woke values. And the way we've done it in a number of ways, but one of the ways that we've done it is through language, which we've just talked about. I wrote just published a piece on November 8th in Spiked explaining how for woke to work to have this kind of mimetic penetration into people's belief system and who speak different languages, it needs to be in English. Because when you every woke word has a different meaning, has multiple meanings, or almost everyone, if I can think of one that doesn't, but they have multiple meanings. But the problem is that those words only translate into the primary meaning. So diversity, for example, we traffic in, you know, or inclusion, everybody should be included, you know, different races, heights. I mean, of course, but inclusion actually means to restrict speech someplace so that people feel welcome. But the secondary definition doesn't translate into whatever language it is. So that's one of the things that they do. What you see, no matter where you go, is that, and even in India, there are videos of the head of the Supreme Court peppering his language with woke terminology. Wokeism has a way to work its way in when people, particularly young people, speak in their language but use woke words. So they'll be speaking and then boom, there's a woke word. Boom, there's a woke word. And they do that because the secondary meaning doesn't translate. Only the primary meaning translates. Was that clear?
I get you. Yeah, I get you. I think, you know, you've just mentioned that street epistemology thing, which I think is so interesting, because you're getting this considered opinion from some people, and other people you just have a reflexive opinion. And it's funny that, you know, if you mention countries like Hungary, people will go, oh, well, that's just because you're a right winger. I mean, just so everyone is clear, your political credentials are far more on the left than on the right. Your own, you would describe yourself, I suppose, as a liberal, right?
Yeah, and just because I'm against bullshit, like just because I'm against wokeism, that doesn't mean that I'm on the right.
Correct, but unfortunately, from their point of view, correct, that is the best way to undermine your argument, is to say, oh, but not just from the right, far right.
Alt-right, far right, correct.
This is what has driven people like you and I together across continents. It's opened
100%.
Up between you and people in the UK and in Sweden and in Australia and all across the United States. It's not as if we came together in order to, you know, in some coerced, concerted way, put up a fight. It's like we were driven into places where there were only a few of us willing to have these conversations. So we met each other.
Correct. And that's, again, to echo what I said before, that's just simply why you can't listen to them. Because you know you're not a Nazi. I know I'm not a Nazi. In fact, even if you extend the semantic range of Nazi to mean like very bad racist person who hates Jews, that's insane. So why? There's just no, they have nothing. There's no point to listen to them. If they want to make a substantive intellectual critique or, I don't know, right? So that's the other thing that's really interesting, and how the rules of the game have changed. Before, if somebody wrote something that you didn't like in academia, well, what you would do is you would write a counter to that. And,
right,
you know, doesn't have to be in the same venue, the same periodical, the same journal, but usually it is. But okay, you want to write another one, that's fine. But now we don't do that anymore. Someone writes a letter that or pens a peer-reviewed article or journal or something that you don't like. Instead of countering those arguments, you smear them. You bring them up on charges, is what happened to my colleague at Portland State University, Bruce Gilley. He's the guy who wrote the famous paper, The Case for Colonialism. And so we're operating with people, again, who have a different rule set. And the rule set is weaponize offices of diversity, equity, inclusion. Go on social media and have go crazy on social media. And that's the other thing with Elon Musk buying that, is they can no longer, the problem with people like Trump, et cetera, being kicked off of Twitter was not because of anything he said or what have you. It's that the rules were not applied equally.
Correct.
And we see that with Matt Taibbi, Barry Weiss, Michael Schellenberger. I'm sorry, go ahead.
People are constantly telling us that they're egalitarian. They seem to want the rules applied very, very differently to their ideological enemies. And they do see, they make no mistake, they see us as their enemies.
Oh, not only enemies, existential threats. You and I are
our biggest. Well, the reason that we have not been winning this argument in so many places is because we have not acknowledged that these people are our intellectual and ideological enemies. We've tried to treat them like reasonable friends instead of like ideological enemies, which is what they've always seen us as.
Yeah, they've seen us as existential threats. But the other reason that we're not losing is because we've brought the wrong tools. The other reason we're not winning is because we've brought the wrong tools. It's like we bring a chessboard to a football game. We are attempting to use reason, argument, dialogue, discourse with people who don't believe in any of these things. So for them, it's all about power and power relations.
So where you have a real edge here, and this is one of my favorite things to do with someone who is a specialist in your, you've written this book, How to Have Impossible Conversations.
Correct.
Are there impossible, there are conversations that are so difficult to have with people like, you know, your ideological enemies, the people who consider you an existential threat. There are some situations where it's just not, for example, if they throw, you know, Nazi accusations at you, you can't really even muddy yourself by having a retort to that. There isn't something that you can say that would be reasonable by attempting to have the discussion with someone who has called you something like that. You almost give them too much credit than they're due.
No,
the right thing to do might be to walk away, or how do you deal with that?
No, not at all. Those are actually easy conversations. Those are very easy. You know, when I taught in the prisons, did my dissertation in the prisons, I was never worried about a prisoner saying "fuck you" to me, or you can have a conversation with anybody, provided one thing, and this is a secret. This is a big secret. As long as they say something back to you, you're good to go. I can give you the tools to navigate that conversation. Excuse me. The problem is when people don't respond to you. The problem is when people won't engage you. That's an impossible conversation. But as long as someone is willing to engage you, they can call you a Nazi. You can call you anything you want. There's just a template that you follow that we've pulled from multiple domains of thought, various lines of literature. It's not magic. It's not these are not the drones you're looking for. It's not, there's nothing mystical or Jedi mind trick about it. It's just drawing from the literature to show, you know, it, using the Socratic method as a base, but there's nothing magical. But you can totally have a conversation with a woke person. The problem is that woke people don't want to have conversations with you. That's the problem.
I'm very aware of how precious your time is, so I don't want to, you know, strong arm you into staying here longer than
I'll stay. It genuinely is always a pleasure to talk to you. Truly.
What's on your agenda in the next stage of this battle? Because you don't sound to me like you're any kind of fading flower. And
no,
with the wind at our backs and Twitter being finally opened up to, and listen, we're prepared to lose arguments, right? I mean, you and I don't want to speak for you, but I don't think I have any problem with arguing with anybody and being proven wrong. I think it would be great for people to take me on in whatever I've said, and I've said lots of things. I'm sure you feel the same way. But with all of this happening now, where at least the playing field seems to be leveling out a little bit, on Twitter anyway, we can't speak for the others.
Yeah.
What is your next move?
Well, just on what you said before, in the Gorgias, Plato says that it is better to be refuted than to refute. He says that's the greater gain of the two. Socrates says that. So I have no problem with being wrong. In fact, it's good because I don't want to be wrong one more second than I have to be, to borrow a quotation.
Explain to me what you think it means that it is better to be refuted than to refute.
Oh, it just means if you engage someone in a conversation or even a debate, I'm not a fan of debates, but a conversation, and if you can refute them, in other words, you can show them that something that they believe to be true is actually not true, or they could do it to you. It's always better if they do it to you, because if they do it to you, then you can rid yourself of a false belief. I want to have as many true false beliefs as possible, but even more important than having true beliefs is to have as few false beliefs as possible. It is far more important to have fewer false beliefs than it is to have more true beliefs. Right?
You see why I needed clarity on that is because you've explained it better than anyone else could.
Oh,
I love that. So what is next?
Oh, okay. So I have such an ambitious year. I'm just hoping my Crohn's disease doesn't kick in, because I have a very ambitious year. So I'm going to go around the world, and I'm going to do these street epistemology, spectrum street epistemology videos, where I'm going to ask, you know, when I was in Eastern Europe, I would ask people, is it better to be ruled by the United States or Russia? And put them on the lines, ask them various questions, and the results were fascinating. And some of the things that people believe is the United States a force for good, and all kinds of questions about everything. So I'm going to go to Puerto Rico. I have a stint in Australia, in Sydney. I'm going to be a visiting a professor there for a few weeks or a month. I'm going back. I'm a founding faculty fellow at the University of Austin, so I'm going to go there and teach. I'm so close to finishing my manuscript. My manuscript is about a young Socrates who roams the ancient Greek countryside and speaks to magical creatures, etc. And he foments this rebellion against the gods, all the while dealing with his anxiety, his extreme anxiety. So it's
right.
You know, he has impossible conversations with people and creatures. So I'm working on that. And then my my next two targets, this is the first time I've said this, so here you go. My last target was something called NPR, which is the extraordinarily woke news organization, very, very prestigious news organization here in the United States. I guess the analog would be the BBC in the UK or ABC in Australia. So I'm going after Wikipedia, which is a minor thing. And then one of my flagship projects is I'm going after the wellspring, the source, the nucleation point of the insanity, which is colleges of education, teacher training programs, because this is the vehicle by which the ideology replicates. And so I'm going
Do you have any idea why? You know, like I asked you about the college educated white women, why do you think it is that the institutions of higher learning have become the nucleus of this whole movement?
Oh, that's an easy question to answer. Unlike your last one, I had no idea. It's because they are, and actually James Lindsay from New Discourses has done some wonderful work on this. I've written about this too. It's because the purpose of education has changed. The purpose of education in virtually every college. Okay, let's take a step back. If one wants to teach in, at least in this country, I can't say about South Africa, but in the United States, if one wants to teach in K through 12, kindergarten through 12th grade, you need a teaching certificate. You can't just walk in there because you've published a lot or you have a PhD or anything. No, you need a teaching certificate. You get teaching certificates from colleges of education. Colleges of education have changed the purpose. Their purpose, they're predicated upon one book. Paulo Freire was a Brazilian educator, The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. He written subsequent books on 1985. That was 72, 1985. But anyway, it's all predicated upon teaching to free people from oppression. Right. So when you understand this, that the purpose of education is to liberate, to develop a critical consciousness, a consciousness of things. When you understand this, you understand, you know, I don't know if you saw that video of the teacher bragging that they're passing out butt plugs to 14-year-olds and drag shows for children.
Again, of a college or a high school.
Yeah, that's right. And the principal subsequently posted posted on social media that they support him, et cetera, et cetera. But when you understand that the purpose of education is not to give people tools to enable them to find the truth, these folks believe they already have the truth. They believe it's in liberation from oppression. And the way that you do that is you use critical theory, you develop a critical consciousness. So this is happening in teacher training programs. And all of these people are, the people who graduate are indoctrinated in the ideology, and then they go through K through 12 and they teach our kids that. They teach children that. So, and I see this with my daughter's curriculum constantly. It's infused in the whole curriculum. There's no, here's the other point, consider this carefully, but undermining this all, and this is a really important point that almost nobody talks about, undermining this all is the idea that there are certain truths about reality based upon race, and it used to be social class of the old left, but they've bartered that now for other identity factors, identity politics. And if you don't believe a certain thing, you're not just wrong, but you're a bad person. So this isn't a, this is really an attempt. They wouldn't say this, but this is an attempt to rob people of their cognitive liberty. For example, I've mentioned repeatedly in this podcast that I'm an atheist. I do not think that there is sufficient evidence to warrant belief in a God or gods. But if I were given that evidence, I will believe. I would believe. Now, with that being said, many people hold, in fact, I'm in the minority. You and I are in the minority on this belief if you look at a global scale.
Absolutely.
I believe that people have a right to believe anything that they want. I have no desire whatsoever to, you know, everybody should have the right to freedom of conscience, a right to live their lives in the way that they see fit. And we have a movement perpetuating itself in college of education that want to rob people of their cognitive liberty. And based upon what you said before, that's one of the reasons that Christians are so supportive of us in this, because this is a battle about liberty. That's why those terms right and left are really no longer applicable. This is about people who are authoritarian or not authoritarian. This is about people who want to give people liberty and who want to rob people of liberty. And one of the ways that this perpetuates itself is in colleges of education. It's in teacher training programs. And we have to undermine their legitimacy. I mean, they're doing it to themselves, but we have to go after these things and expose the problem. I have a great video on my channel from Dr. Lyle Asher, who explains this in great detail.
You have a lot of work ahead of you.
We're losing, but the tide is turning. Yeah.
You're taking on Wikipedia, you're taking on colleges and teachers training. I mean, this is a big deal. All the strength to you, my friend. I can't imagine a more worthy cause. You know, if you go down in flames, this will be a hell of a thing to go down in flames.
Thanks. It's a good thing to be 56. I'm 56. I'm not beholden to anybody. You know, like people used to try to, I used to have just a truly unbelievable amount of stress and grief and anxiety in my life, constantly complaining about me, filing false complaints. I've been investigated for everything, all these multiple investigations. I don't even know how much money they spent. You know what they found? Nothing, because there was nothing to find. It was a fucking witch hunt. But now I don't have to worry about every time someone sends me an angry letter. I sent them the email to the Office of Diversity, Equity, Inclusion at Portland State, and they say, "Why don't you complain in as much detail as you want to them?" In other words, fuck you. So, if you want to participate in it, I welcome everybody to join. You know, this is a nonprofit thing. We can win this. And you know, you're right. Musk has bought Twitter. That's changing. People are not afraid to speak up anymore. Almost everybody realizes that this is a deranged ideology. Almost everybody who's not caught in the wake of it. So now the thing is, we have to fight back. And don't worry about not fighting back. You're going to lose your friends or what have you. Your friends will respect you more, not less, if you speak openly and honestly to them. And if they don't, those friendships were not friendships of virtue, and they're not worth keeping.
And don't apologize.
Never, never,
never, never give an inch to these lunatics.
Nothing, zero.
I can't really end on a better note than that. So I think that's a perfect place to wrap it up. Peter Boghossian, it's such a pleasure to speak to you.
The honor is mine. And
I'm delighted to have a bit of your time and your excellent brain. It's like food for the
thank you,
the soul. Listen, keep doing the good work. I hope you have a wonderful Christmas and New Year, and get together in the new year and start again.
I would love that. Thank you so much for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Great to see you. Thank you. CliffCentral.com.